Okay, welcome back to the Investigative Journal on this September 12th, 2014 day in our calendar. I'm your host, Greg Anthony, and we're here every Monday through Friday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Today I want to get back and talk a little bit about the particulars of the Tony Alamo case. And in the past months I've been whittling away at the flimsy evidence that the government has provided. And the whole case is a shocking example of how Christian ministries have been attacked by anyone who does not fall in line lockstep with the Vatican in their ecumenical movement. I've seen it happen in the past to other ministries, and as we go into history, we see that this is a pattern that hasn't ended. The Vatican's quite cagey when it begins its new propaganda campaign in America regarding accepting all faiths, Protestantism included, as long as they don't step on the toes of the Pope. And as long as the Pope can do what he can do in this country, everything is fine. You get your 501c3 money, you all go and sing at the Vatican together, allowing freedom of religion. But the real point is that that isn't what freedom of religion is. What it is a total understanding of what the history of this organization has been, what have they been doing in this country, and how they have attacked a ministry. I've been using the Tony Alamo ministry as an example because it is an egregious affair. When you look at how this was orchestrated, when it occurred in 2008, it was a complete SWAT team, a SWAT team rampage on a Christian ministry where there were some kids playing on the swings. They were there to arrest Tony, but he wasn't even there. And the 150 news media outlets were alerted to this, and the whole thing was spread real quickly, at the snap of a finger, all over the news broadcast, that this man who is accused of all these egregious crimes against children has to be put in jail. But when you look at what he's been charged with, it's flimsy at best. And to put a man in jail, he sits in jail now for 175 years, as well as attacking his ministry. You know, really, it's a complete demolishing of this ministry. There's been a civil case where hundreds of millions of dollars have been awarded to these victims. There's four or five of them. And I'll get into that later on today or maybe in another show. But if we look back at what happened here, a guy named Frank Lockwood talked about it. He said, when state and federal law enforcement officials swooped into Tony Alamo Ministries, this was... Oh, and also, you know, I was reading blogs about this, and all these people that have convicted him. In one blog, Matt Damon, okay, the actor, right? He goes, glad this man's in jail. Now, Matt, you got a lot of money. Why don't you do some research on the case? Why don't you do a little bit of research into the Vatican? You know, it's just amazing to me how everybody just jumps on the bandwagon without even allowing someone to defend themselves. And when they do defend themselves in a court case like this, you'll see that the courts really didn't give him a fair trial at all. It was more of a kangaroo court. But in 2008, when this occurred, when state and federal law enforcement officials swooped down on the Alamo Ministries, many, if not most, of the major news organizations in Arkansas were watching it unfold. This wasn't how it was supposed to be. The raid was originally scheduled for sometime in October. Well, they had to do it in September, but on Friday, somebody in the U.S. Attorney's Office inadvertently sent an email about the raid several weeks early. Why are they alerting 50 media outlets across the state about this? What is this, some kind of, dog and pony show? With the cat out of the bag, law enforcement officials moved up their time schedule. Newspapers had to decide whether to go with the story in Saturday's editions, that was back in September of 2008, or wait a day or so. With children reportedly in the compound and with allegations of child abuse, every news organization in the state voluntarily refrained from writing about that raid until it had already begun. So they were already going to write about it prior to it even happening. I mean, give me a break. Then, you know, we saw how this thing unfolded, and I remember back then when it happened, and actually, because Tony had talked against the Vatican, and I wanted to see if I could find anybody in this country that still did that. You know, it's an endangered species. No church. I mean, I've gone to so many of these Protestant churches and talked to these pastors. And, oh, they may say a word to you privately, but they're never going to say anything in public because they know. Some of them know, some don't. But basically, both of them, if they know, don't know, they shouldn't be a pastor. And two, if they do know, then they're hiding something and they shouldn't be one either. So I don't give them any leeway. It's ridiculous. And we've just totally wiped out 500 years of history just to suit, you know, a new Protestantism. It isn't a new Protestantism. It's Catholicism wrapped in a Protestant bow. But what I'm getting at is, so during that time when this occurred, I was contacted, and what happened was they took these children into custody. These SWAT team members came down and, you know, with their rifles and in their black suits and scared the hell out of these kids. And they not only did that, but then there was a judge ordered that all the children in all his ministries across the country run down and taken into custody. So basically, they ended up with, I don't know, 35 or 40, and then parents were taking their kids out of the ministry because... my dog's here talking to somebody, but anyway, what happened was they were dismantling it from stem to stern, and the reason they were doing that was because it wasn't only Tony they were after. They wanted to stop anybody that would be involved with this type of, what was it? Basically telling the truth about the Pope and his relationships with our government and how Georgetown University and the Vatican really runs our foreign policy. All right. Tell the truth and you're going to get screwed here. Right. That's exactly what happened. So I documented this many stories I've talked about this. And it's an example of why I'm using it as an example is that something like this comes out, it sends a chilling effect throughout the country. And it says to other people who may believe the same things, who may believe in a strict, you know, may believe in certain things regarding what we talk about on this show and in their certain Bible beliefs, which call the Vatican the Antichrist, it means they have to either do it quietly or they can't do it at all because they fear arrest, fear. And basically it sends a chilling effect to any other ministries. Don't do this or you're going to get the same thing will happen to you. And at the same time, they are targeting these type of ministries. Now, the other day I talked to you before John Paul II, a supposed saint. He was a cyanide salesman in Poland before this. Did anybody ever check his background before he became pope? Well, anyway, that can easily be covered up by the people who write revisionist history anyway. But let's look at this. What did John Paul say? He, in his own words, stated that the real problem is these splinter groups, these ministries like Tony Alamo's, who are preaching this kind of discord, preaching this kind of message, which is basically, don't criticize us. And he said, this needs to be stopped. And I remember reading that to you a week or two ago. So we know what they were looking for. And they've been checking around. And because Tony Alamo's ministry was very successful, he helped a lot of people, he had been doing this for 40 years, sending out pamphlets and brochures regarding really what's behind the scenes in our government, like much of what we talk about in this show and other people who do the same thing. But their audience isn't as big. He had a large audience. He used to go on, spend a lot of money on shortwave radio, spend a lot of money on brochures, passing them out, millions of them. He had land holdings, and his ministry was successful, and he had different churches across the country. And so, you know, he's a perfect target. Let's stop this before it grows. We've got to set an example, send a chilling effect through the country, plus put him out of business, not only put him in jail for 175 years, but dismantle this ministry, which they're doing as we speak. After the criminal case where Tony sits in jail now, there's been a civil case where they've been awarded the largest, there's been a settlement for the people who filed the case against him, or four or five of them, for over $530 million in Arkansas, the largest in the history of the state. And they're dismantling right now as we speak, trying to get all of his holdings, all of his ministries put in and sold, and then basically the ministry no longer exists. That was their goal to begin with. It's a total federal effort to wipe him off the map. Now, how did they do that? I thought I'd spend a little time. I've got some general information regarding the people who filed, you know, the four or five victims in the criminal case, who then transferred over to the civil case. And I am going to go in future shows to the appeal, which talks about the incongruities in the case, his appeal, and his motion for a new trial, which will get into the legalities of all these and how these charges, I believe, were flimsy, and how basically the judge did not allow even a lot of circumstantial evidence that might have helped this case. See, I made a case the other day that this trial reminded me of the Charles Chiniquy trial, when Lincoln, prior to him being president, represented Chiniquy, who was a Catholic priest who was talking against the Vatican in a similar manner Tony is, but back then there were more people talking about it then. You know, this thing has gotten quieter and quieter and quieter as we speak, because people have been brainwashed, you know, over the years, and they have been taking a lot of the information which showed Rome's and the Vatican's intentions of overthrowing this country and fomenting the Civil War and being involved in the Lincoln assassination. Do you think they've changed now? So basically what happens, Lincoln states that part of Chiniquy is accused of rape. And it turned out that it was a sister of a Jesuit priest, and she was set up to frame this man for his views against the Vatican and what they were doing during that period of time in our history. So basically, Lincoln said, I have documents that'll prove that he is being framed because of his views, and I want those brought up, and I want the Bishop of Chicago to testify. I want these records to be brought out in the open, and I believe this is relevant to the case. Guess what? The judge says, yes, it's relevant. So some damning information came out in that court case that you don't even see today. All you great legal scholars and all you great lawyers and you people on the judiciary committees, you know, give me a break. Who are you beholden to first? This country and its constitution, or the Pope in Rome? And I bet you it's the latter. Now listen to me carefully here. So basically what happens is Lincoln, the judge, says it's relevant. Now that's a judgment call. The judge can say, hey, it has no relevancy to this case, and you can appeal it, counselor, and see if it's overturned on an appeal, or it's relevant. He thought it was relevant, and as the information came out about this Vatican and governmental conspiracy to overthrow this country came out, oh, the Jesuits were biting their tongues in the courtroom. And eventually, he gets acquitted. Chiniquy gets acquitted and warns Lincoln that they will never forget and they will kill you one day, and they did. So in the Alamo case, his original defense attorney, who I'm told they weren't pleased with the defense in the beginning, and as it went on, I think they're satisfied with the lawyer they have now that's working on the appeal. However, He had tried to get into information. Well, the question is, did he really try, or basically this? John, there were a couple of people. Tony was saying also, listen, I'm being framed, part, you know, because of my views, because of the same reason that Chiniqui was being framed. And I have a couple FBI, I have an FBI agent that will testify that he was set up to bring me and my ministry down and to frame me. Now, you think the judge in this case felt it was irrelevant. Well, that's what's happened over the years. Beholden to not the Constitution and not the rights of the defense, but the right of the defendant here to prove he's, you know, to show that he's innocent before he's proven guilty. And the judge, it's a judgment call, so the judge says, no, it's not relevant, and you can appeal this, counselor. A big, big issue. Now, secondly, let's talk about the four or five victims generally. Now, I'm going to go over in a couple shows all the legalities in the appeal and piece through that and show you what he's saying. But there are some generalities here we can talk about that I've learned regarding these people and what really happened. And I'm going to give you that today so you get kind of an overview of what he was charged with, and does it merit 175 years? I mean, look at what's going on in the Vatican. And I mean, I've got cases that were priests were burying dead bodies, baby bodies, and under altars, and witnessed by children, and they were trying to get somebody to investigate this, and it never got investigated. The priest was never taken into custody. There was no SWAT team raids. And then you look at all the child abuse cases that the Vatican's been involved with all over the world. Since when did they close down a church? When did they SWAT? When did the SWAT team come in? Many times these priests were hidden away, were sent to other countries, so they could do this again in complicity with the Vatican. And then, you know, I've done so many stories regarding convents, you know, these cloistered convents where abuse was going on and nuns couldn't get any justice, even the ones that wanted to. It's just an incredible story of how we have a double standard in this country regarding that organization and what happened to this man. And I want you to think about that. Now, there were five young women now labeled victims in the 2008 raid on Alamo in the case against him by the government. And they were around lots of people every day while living in the church. They were there for years. Their parents gave permission for them to live at the school in the mission, and kept in close contact with them after they moved there. The parents visited whenever they wanted, and they could come by freely. They weren't locked away. They weren't being brainwashed. These girls could have gone back home to their parents at any time. And four or five of them, now their names I'll give you, it's out in the public anyway. I believe it's, well, anyway, let's talk, I think they're grown up now anyway. Amy, Jeanette, Desiree, Summer did go back to their parents at various times, I've learned, only to want to return and asked over and over until they finally got permission to do so. Now, the point I'm trying to make is when you run a school like this or a ministry like this, you're going to run into a lot of different people on a daily basis. Some with good intentions, some with bad, and you're dealing with a lot of different personalities. And what I learned from people there who have got me some information is that all these people left between 2003 and 2006, but not one complaint from any of them at the time. Then all at once, the ministry told me they were starting to get calls that the FBI was scouring the U.S. for anyone who would testify against Tony. I was told that they were hounded by many people who told us they refused the offers of money to come into the FBI office to talk. They called their homes at work day and night, We know of one family who actually went into hiding to get away from the constant harassment because they would not agree to go along with the FBI. So they're getting harassed if they didn't give the FBI what they wanted. Now, listen, yesterday was 9/11. Now, I did a lot of research into 9/11 and talked to a, you know, I mean, I would talk to a victim who lost his son in the World Trade Center, who actually went to the top of the FBI to get information that, listen, it didn't happen this way. And the FBI director at the time lied to him. This is what the man told me. So if they're going to lie and coerce and do all the things they did, and I saw so many discrepancies of the FBI during 9/11 as far as the black boxes and as far as planting evidence and all this kind of stuff. So why, if they're going to lie about 9/11, why do you believe them in cases like this? When you got people talking, person from the ministry saying, listen, these people are harassing me, trying to get me to testify, offering me money. But you know, Americans and Matt Damon, you included, you're not going to even look past your nose to find out what really happened here. Because it's pretty convenient for you, isn't it? Right. Just to say, hey, this man's guilty, these churches were a cult, but the biggest cult, I say, if you read the definition of a cult, is the Catholic Church. And I have no bones to pick against them. I was born a Catholic. I had a good Catholic education. But it's the responsibility of every person to look into the hierarchy of the organizations you're involved with. Now, throughout my life, I don't get involved in too many. But one I was involved with by birth, two, was the United States as a citizen. I was forced into it. And I was born a Catholic, so I wanted to find out what the hell both of them were about. And what I found out is just appalling. And I guess I can say it because I don't have much to lose. It's people like Matt Damon who have millions to lose that'll probably keep their mouth shut the rest of their life just to protect their own little pocketbook. And that's fine. I have nothing against those people. If that's what you want to do, do it. And you can go on making movies, and I like a lot of his movies. I'm nothing against the man. I'm just saying this is the reason probably why it's happening. And if he makes that choice, that's his right. But if we understand that, then maybe we can live a little bit better, can't we? By all leveling with one another. And that's the way I look at it. But I'm just starting on this, and I want to talk a little bit more about some of the information I learned from the inside about these people. And how, you know, irregular it is. I mean, why are they combing the country, trying to coerce people and trying to get as much evidence as they can when, in the end, they got very little. But it amounted to 175 years when you add on all the media hype, when you add on all the speculation about, you know, the media calling this a compound, a cult. But then the poor guy, Tony, in a sense I say that from the standpoint of how this defense was, he couldn't even get into testimony the possibilities of the reasons why they were targeting him, because he was saying he was framed for his views, just like Chiniqui was. And he couldn't even get that into court. And many people have told me that the Arkansas Federal District Court is probably one of the most corrupt in the country. I don't know how they figured that out, but that's what I was told. And I wouldn't doubt it. All right, so we're going to come back and finish up a little bit of this information. And listen, you're listening to the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Anthony. And we're here every Monday through Friday on First Amendment Radio from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., and my show is called The Investigative Journal, and we're going to be back right after these short messages on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Oh,
Hear it first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
I know you all want answers, and believe me, so do I, and I'll do my best to get them.
Have you seen the Left Behind movies? Have you read the Left Behind fictional book series? Not everyone believes Left Behind is true prophecy. Some may even regard as conspiratorial the mainstream re-release of the Left Behind movie with actor Nicolas Cage portraying the main character as an attempt to further reinforce in the minds of all this perception of false prophecy in order to condition the masses for the play about to begin. Because they see the world stage shaping to fulfill what they have been led to believe is sound biblical interpretation, a left-behind rapture scenario, this false view of prophecy is reinforced in the mind, not only of its adherents, but also includes those who have been merely exposed to the specific media. Is it possible that false prophecy can be fulfilled? The rapture theories have always been in dispute. Pre-trib, mid-trib, and post-trib disputes have risen up in exclusively evangelical circles of recent history, so that when true believers don't suddenly disappear, this element will easily go by the wayside when all see a new Jewish temple begin to be built. Will this be part of the great delusion that will come upon the whole earth? It seems that this great prophetic delusion has already overcome practically the entire American evangelical and Christian world. Get the book, The Rapture Will Be Canceled. To learn more, visit crosstheborder.org. That's C-R-O-S-S, crosstheborder.org.
Since the beginning of time, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it, it has been traded, it has been borrowed, it has been purchased, it has been stolen. There's a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188 or visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, right here on FirstAmendmentRadio.com at 4 p.m. Eastern or 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, 1-800-375-4188.
Okay, we're back for the second half hour of the Investigative Journal, and I'm trying to give you some general information on some of the evidence that the government had to convict Tony Alamo and put him in jail for 175 years. And before I, in the later shows, go into the appeal that he's written, that his attorneys have written, and getting into the incongruities and the flimsiness of this evidence, let's mention there were four or five people that testified against him and were used by the government to convict him. And this is some of the background information I've learned about them. Remember I said that there were four or five girls, and they left the ministry from 2003 to 2006. Now, also, some of the girls were put there because they were troublesome with their parents, and the parents had trouble taking care of them, so they left them at the ministry. Now, they all left between 2003 and 2006, I had learned, and there weren't any complaints at that time. And they were free to go, and they could leave, and if there was a complaint, question is, why didn't they go to the authorities then? Then all at once I heard people at the ministry were telling me that they were getting calls from the FBI, that these people were all getting calls from the FBI scouring the U.S. for anyone, this is back in that period of time, who would testify against Tony. So this has been an orchestrated effort for a while. And if you look at the history of this ministry, this isn't the first time they tried to convict him. They tried on these charges prior to that, and they didn't stick. Then they had him in jail for IRS charges that were bogus, too, when you started looking at those. But that also happened to Tupper Saucy, the person I'm also writing. You know, I thought I'd do a couple theater plays on this, because you very seldom see this stuff out in the open, don't you? Now, Tupper was he wrote a book called Rulers of Evil, and I think anybody who is interested in any of this information ought to read that book, including Matt Damon. I'm sure you got time. But anyway, what I'm getting at is he was also charged with bogus IRS charges to shut him up for the same type of information, contrary to the Vatican's likings. And it's a great book. It gives you a lot of good information to get started on investigating even more stuff. And Tupper even found out that his prosecutor was a Jesuit. Now, so we got the FBI now hounding people, and when they refused the offers of money to come into the FBI office to talk, they were called at their homes at work day and night. And you know, when this starts happening, you know, people get a little. Let's say, you know, the FBI starts calling around your house. People, neighbors are going to say, "Hey, what's he?" You know, pretty soon the guilty, before even a chance to talk, he's got to be guilty if the FBI is here. So they get a little. Families were getting actually nervous, and they were hiding to get away from this constant harassment, I was told. Now, again, I was told that these girls were around a lot of people every day. Their teachers, the adults who lived there, their parents, and anyone who came over, which was many each day, I was told, while they were there. Their office, basically, at their ministry is like Grand Central Station, very busy, people coming and going day and night. They're helping people, feeding people who are homeless, things like that. No complaints, however, from these people who finally the government used to put Tony in jail. Other than, you know, the squabbles with their friends like you'd normally have. But certainly there, I was told during this period of time, there was no mention of discontent towards Tony. As a matter of fact, I was told, each of these were at various times for some of these people that testify, various times for being disrupted and causing problems in school or with others, or lying, as in one of the girls' cases, told to move to another location. They were, you know, some of them were troublesome. And that goes on at the ministry. Each one repeatedly asked to return. That's an interesting fact. They all asked to come back. In fact, some of them directly wrote Tony and told him they were sorry for the trouble they had caused and could they please come back. Many of these handwritten letters are still in our possession. And why didn't a lot of this stuff get into testimony? Why did they do this if they were victims? We have their letters in black and white. I mean, why? And I can't understand why this stuff was never. Did he get an initial good defense? I don't think so. And who was the defense? You know. Well, anyway, one of the girls came from a big family. All kids were pretty good kids, but one of them was kind of a troublemaker. She was habitual and uncontrollable, a liar, a schemer, and her mother finally gave up and just could not handle her. She asked if she could stay at the school and mission with her mother's sister, her aunt, who she loved. It seemed to really help get her straightened out to a degree. Her mother frequently visited, went home, often weekends or school vacations. She also lived for almost a half a year with her mother before returning to the school and mission. So they were coming and going. It wasn't like they were being kidnapped or a cult where they, you know, they weren't allowed to leave. No, not at all. But the lying and conniving on this one person never stopped. Her mother and father knew how easily the FBI used her. She was sent to Wellsprings in Albany, Ohio, for 2-week intensive counseling. Okay. She loved the constant attention, I was told, as they were giving her. They made her feel like she was the center of their world. She ate it up, and when they gave her balloons and gifts on Valentine's Day, presents, up until the trial, the government paid for the phones, upon which they kept tabs on her and kept her under their control. So who basically is keeping this girl locked away? It seems like it's the shoes on the other foot here. They acted like they were so concerned for her and helped her move, get a job. She admitted she was paid for. When she admitted on stand, she never even spent one day on the job, and so much more. She admitted the special FBI agent called her at least 80 times before trial. All the while, she was sitting at the head of the prosecution table, coaching her by shaking his head. No. Several people watched this from the gallery, although he denied it, of course. When her mother tried to witness for Tony against her daughter, the prosecutor, knowing just how to shut her down, asked her where she lived and where her other children were. Since she knew Child Protective Services would take them instantly, as there was still a standing pickup order that she was promptly served as she arrived at the courthouse to testify, she had no choice but to plead the fifth. So she doesn't even testify against Alamo. She pleads the fifth, and she was afraid to testify on his behalf because she would have her children taken away, and that shut her down. The judge told her to step down. He told the jury to strike anything they heard her say. He repeated it again the next morning. Another girl that testified against him moved in with her mother and siblings to the ministry in Fort Smith around 1996. They left their dad when he was found to be cheating on his wife. This particular girl didn't get along with her mother and asked to move to the Fox School, that's in Arkansas, and Mission before Tony got out of prison in 1998, and that was for his IRS charge. That, of course, was bogus. In 2003, she was causing havoc at the church. She had an out-of-control temper, and she was very angry at Pebbles, who lived there as well. She was told to move back with her mother, right? But she didn't get along with her and didn't want that. So she was causing problems at the ministry. And can you imagine when you get all these people there, some from homes that are broken homes, single mothers, things of this nature. People, parents that are having trouble with their children, they figure this kind of environment may help them. There's going to be some problems. So she was told, this particular girl that testified against him was told to move back to her mother. But she didn't get along with her and didn't want that. She was given the alternative of moving to another house nearby with others, but she didn't want to do that either. Instead, she chose to move to Oklahoma and live with her dad. And at the time of the raid and Tony's arrest, her dad sent emails of support to Tony. This is one that testified against her. She sent an email sending regards to all after leaving. No hostilities, nothing. Eventually, she was contacted by the FBI and sent to Wellsprings, where with her child for 2 weeks. Now, here we go. They're bringing them there for what? To counsel them? I mean, did something happen or didn't it? One, you know, but no, they got to coerce. They've got to find some information to put this guy away. The same thing that happened with the other girl's mother happened to this one's mother. They questioned her on the child's whereabouts, and she was forced to plead the fifth, figuring she's going to lose everything. She was, you know, her testimony is incomplete and completely stricken. So we're getting parents afraid to testify on Tony's behalf because they're afraid their whole life will be turned upside down by these, you know, by the government who's big hand is stepping in here and manipulating this trial. Another one lived in New Jersey with her family. Another one that testified till her mother left her dad and her sister drove off one day in 2001. They moved back to Texarkana and later both lived in the house next door to the school and the mission. Eventually, one of the sisters went to live with her mother, and this one came back to live with the ministry in 2003. We were informed that she and her mother were being harassed by the FBI, another one, and kept trying to hold them off. But finally, they agreed to meet them. The FBI offered to send this girl to art college, we were told. So, what I gather here is that if the FBI says, listen, we'll send you to art college and pay for it, but you got to testify against Tony, because we got to convict this guy. Now, give me a break. Is that a frame job or what? She agreed to be a witness as well as her mother. Another one lived next door to the school and mission. Came over every day with her sister. Finally asked to stay there. It was fine with her parents, but her mom stopped in often and visited with her outside while they played after school. The sisters both moved back home after a while. Then in 2003, this girl only moved back to the school and mission. After 2 or 3 years, she went back to live with her parents. So they're coming and going freely as they wish. And so in 2004, 2005, she goes back, their parents, and we were told, the ministry was told that the FBI was contacting a family or members of her grandfather and was really trying to get her to become a witness. She eventually went to live with them, and she too became a hostile witness. Then another one lived with the ministry in 1993. Her parents moved her into the house that they were living in Fort Smith, just a few months before Tony left for Memphis and the IRS trial to begin in 93. She moved into the house in Memphis. Her parents and her family moved there as well. When we moved to Colorado, when Tony was assigned to the prison in Florence, Colorado, her family moved there also. So she was always around her family. In the early 2000s, she actually accused her own father of having sexual relations with her. Due to this, her family moved away from the ministry. Years later, she admitted if really was not true, that her father didn't do this, but that the damage had been done to the entire family. So we have somebody that admitted lying about a sexual crime committed against her, used by the government to testify against Tony. In 2005, she decided to go to live with them, right? But within a few months, she called and spoke to a friend at the church, crying and very depressed. And when she was told she could come back, she immediately did so. So here we got somebody testifying against him that wants to come back to the ministry, has lied about her father. But in 2006, due to her terrible lies from the past and her very bad attitude and more, she was asked to leave again. A troublemaker, perhaps. And this goes on. She didn't want to go, but couldn't stay any longer. We were told the FBI started trying to get to her. That's what the ministry told me. They were trying to get to this girl, and she insisted she wanted nothing to do with them. Then, for some reason, she started to cooperate. There's a possibility, people from the ministry said, she could have been threatened with her parents being prosecuted if she didn't comply. So to protect them or other reasons, she had to turn on Tony. She, too, went to Wellsprings for 2 weeks, and all was paid for going there. So we got these witnesses, and this is just some general information that I get from going a little bit deeper into the case. And it seems a bit flimsy to me to put a guy in jail for 175 years. And if you compare it to some of the atrocities that go on in the Catholic Church and all the priests around the world, it is just amazing to me. And then when you put into the mix that he's being framed because of his views, and there's a big pot of money to get, and money's out here, and they're paying for these people and coercing them and harassing them, and they looked all over the place for others too, and they can only come up with this. So to me, there has to be something more going on here than just what we're told in the mainstream media and how this trial went and the number of years this man is spending for this. So I wanted to, you know, bring some of this information to you. So in a general basis, so that when we look at some of the, when we look at the appeal, we can compare it to what was appealable, what isn't, and that gets into a sticky, you know, that gets, he's asking for a motion for a retrial, that the whole trial was a sham, and that probably is there's a strong case for that than just what's going to be appealable in the record that was allowed in, because there's much that wasn't allowed in it. And I imagine you can appeal some of that information as well. But what I wanted to get at was that I hope I can gather more information that I got here. We're only dealing with four or five victims over a period of 40 years, and we're seeing that many of them were offered gifts, were offered for their college to be paid. Some have proven to be lied about sexual crimes committed against them. Even one lied about her father doing it. Some of them were discontented children that chose to come back there because they couldn't get along with their parents. So there's a lot of things here that make me believe that something more was up, that there was a frame job in the works. And if you look at the history of this, going back to when he began, how they wanted to keep him quiet from the beginning, it's a perfect example of how a Christian ministry has to toe the line and either join the ecumenical movement, the Vatican movement, or basically you're going to receive the same fate, especially if you become popular and you start talking to a lot of people. And basically that's what the Alamo ministry was. The position of it now is pretty almost in, you know, they're taking it apart piece by piece. And Tony had wanted to mention that this is a complete federal effort to destroy everything he started and to destroy a Christian ministry. There had recently been a $525 million civil judgment against him. This is the largest judgment in Arkansas history, according to one of the plaintiff's attorneys. And they're going after all of his holdings and everything in all the different places where his churches exist. So we'll look into some of the specifics of that in future shows as well. I wanted to stop by saying that one of the two, the big, there are a couple, you know, people throughout, a few people throughout the years that I've been following this story have come forward to me and told me, you know, some things. And I just wanted to mention that. I thought it was important that anyone who wanted to look at the stories that we talk about, the coercion between the Vatican and our government in all aspects, 9/11 and what's going on as far as, you know, the whittling away of our rights, what the direction of this country, and pinning that actually the Vatican is very much involved in the direction of this country from the beginning. I thought it would be very interesting to show how a person in a ministry was taken down for their views, just as they were during the time of the Reformation. And this story really exemplifies that. Now, I know there's going to be many people in this country, and the Vatican and the government will also rely on this, that they believe everything they hear from their government, everything they hear on the news, and he must be guilty. Now, I'm not trying to sway you one way or the other. I'm just saying that as a journalist, I thought this story needed to be looked at a little bit in depth, and the man needed some type of, I mean, the information that was never given him the opportunity in court needed to get out, at least in the court of public opinion, so people could start looking at really what's going on behind the scenes. All you people that think that you know, that understand that 9/11 was an inside job, that should give you credence and should give you enough sense to realize that if they would lie about something like that and hide that, what else would they do? And how many other people have experienced what this ministry is going through because of their views in a supposed country where we have freedom of religion and freedom of the press? That's the importance of this story. That's why I wanted to do a theatrical play about it, and I'm working on it right now, as well as one on Tupper Saucy. And you're going to see two different views here. One, we're going to dwell on the biblical side of it, and the other on the secular side. And when you bring the two together, it's a very forceful story, one that I believe many people just want to ignore in this country, and I'm saying you can't. And hopefully we can get more information regarding what really went on at some of the, you know, how do they coerce all these, you know, what is it? I mean, they can take people into these, you know, take them in and offer them gifts and all this kind of stuff. As long as you tell, you know, what we want you to tell, what you want, because our end, the ends justifies the means here. And the ends in this case was to keep him quiet from speaking up against the Vatican and our government and how they work together. And two, to get all of his holdings and money and to destroy this ministry lock, stock, and barrel. And that's basically what's going on as we speak. And hopefully somebody will listen to this side of the story. And I'm not, like I said, listen to what the other side says. You got enough of that, you can go on the internet and find a lot of it. And then look at this side. And then understand that you have to make up your own mind. And hopefully, I don't see how you can justify 175 years based on what they presented. It's amazing to me that this occurred. But anyway, it happened right here in the United States. And we're going to continue covering it. And hopefully we can get some more information as the weeks go on. But anyway, we're all out of time again on the Investigative Journal. I'll be back next week, Monday. And you can catch me on FirstAmendmentRadio.com and also at my website at ArcticBeacon.com. And we'll continue with this story and others. So, have a good weekend and good night.